You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. If you're worried about the direction of our country, if you're uneasy with what's going on in the White House and at the same time frustrated with the infighting among Democrats and lack of focus on the big picture, well, you're not alone. Today's guest has written a really excellent new book called The Democracy Fix. She joins us in a moment. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. I'm very happy now to welcome Caroline Fredrickson. She's president of the American Constitution Society. She's served as special assistant to President Clinton for legislative affairs. She's been a staffer on Capitol Hill for several senators. And she's author of the new book, The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. Welcome, Caroline.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your book is about an array of threats to democracy. Some of these include redistricting or gerrymandering, restrictions on voting, packing the courts with conservative activist judges, a host of campaign finance issues that give disproportionate power to the wealthy, an extensive right-wing media establishment. I mean, all of these things give more power to the already powerful, less power to the most vulnerable people in the United States. And the book is also, at least to me, it's about the huge asymmetries between the Democratic and Republican parties and how they think and operate and whom they serve. And the situation that we're in right now, which a lot of people all over the kind of ideological map are very concerned about, is kind of the fruit of some seeds that we planted over four decades ago when the United States was in an extraordinarily progressive moment. We'd passed environmental and civil rights legislation. The heart and soul of the country seemed to be kind of in line with these values. But under that surface, there was a backlash quietly taking place. And I wondered if you could talk about those roots, Lewis Powell, his memo, and then the resulting kind of what they call the long game that's been playing out ever since.
Well, absolutely. And that is, I think, the fundamental heart of my book is looking back at that history and trying to understand why and how exactly the right has been able to capture power and hold it for so long. Why, when we so many people thought that the future was moving in a progressive direction, we've had these setbacks, why they've been able to undermine core elements of our democracy. And so this was something that, you know, was the brainchild of a future Supreme Court Justice, Lewis Powell, who was very active in the Chamber of Commerce. He was a big tobacco lawyer. He sat on the board of Philip Morris. And, you know, in the early 70s, he was really frightened by just the very victories that you mentioned, the environmental movement, the civil rights movement, and also the consumer litigation that was happening in the courts under lawyers like Ralph Nader, where corporate America was actually being held to account for killing people with dangerous products. So you had him seeing this horizon where corporations and big business were actually going to be regulated and that there would be a cost to their bottom line. And he thought that that was actually a direct threat to the whole free enterprise system, and capitalism was, you know, under attack. And so he wrote this memo, and it's really worth reading. It's very easy to find. Just type in Lewis Powell memo into any search engine. You come up with, you know, his archives, which has the memo, and it lays out in, you know, absolute, you know, it's, you look at it and you think, okay, and they did it all. So what he advises was for the right to fund for the long term a broad range of institutions that could exert control over the instrumentalities of power. It's all about power, but essentially that's what he got. Power exists in different spheres. Some of it's in government and not just in the elected branches, but also in the courts. And some of it's in the media. And so, you know, he identified these areas that needed long-term consistent funding from the right, He wrote this memo for the Chamber of Commerce. It quickly circulated through the highest levels of the business community, as well as, and of course, this is very important, the major funders on the right, the people that we know and don't love, the Koch brothers and the Bradleys and the Mercers and others, who quickly came to the table and said, this is what we were looking for. This is our roadmap. And they set up a bunch of organizations that we know, and I'd say know and loathe, the Moral Majority, the Heritage Foundation, and others, and then spent money on making sure that they could carry out this effort, which included producing model legislation to suppress the vote, to radically gerrymander so that only Republicans would ever get elected, and to ensure that the court system was hostile to civil rights claims and consumer claims, and to destroy the environmental rights movement. And so that's what they did. And that's, we're still seeing the impact of that long-term vision.
We are. And then there are occasional, what you might call, setbacks for that vision, like the election of Obama and the election of many Democrats in 2008. But of course, you know, there was an immediate reaction to that. Talk about this plan called Project Red Map. It put $30 million into selected state legislative races, which sounds like a lot of money, but it really is a modest amount of money in terms of political campaigns. How did they spend it? What did they get for their investment?
Well, and I highly recommend another book, which I know I'm not supposed to do when I'm talking about my book, but if you want to just dive into Red Map, David Daley's book, which is called Rat Effed.
Yes. Yeah, we talked about that on this program.
I'm sure you talked to David Daley. Yeah. But he goes really deep into it. But basically what it was, you know, it was hiding in plain sight. Actually, Karl Rove, who was one of George Bush's Republican operatives, he wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal in 2009, basically saying, here's what we're doing. I'm sure he was drumming up money for the project, but you know, they identified just those state legislative seats that they needed to win to flip a state house in a state where the governor was a Republican. And so that they could take over the state house, adopt a highly rigged redistricting plan so that they set up the state house to be even more Republican and took over even more congressional seats. And they did it with such finesse. And as you said, it didn't cost very much because it had so many downstream benefits for them. So including with this incredible lock on Congress, which, you know, the Democrats are in control now, but if the vote actually reflected what the majority of people want in this country, you'd have a lot more Democrats than you do. But it also meant that the state legislatures then passed even more legislation to suppress the vote and affect democracy. So you have a state like North Carolina, where this effort was highly successful. And they put a lot of money into the state house elections. They took over the state house, and then they passed something they called the Monster Election Law, which went and changed state districts. It changed the election boards. It suppressed the vote. It got rid of early voting. It made it, they added a photo ID and on and on, and went so far as to take judicial elections, which had been nonpartisan up till that point in North Carolina. They made those partisan. And then, of course, they gerrymandered those as well, because, you know, you got to have the judges on your side, too.
Right. Now, one of the things that we've seen all over the country when Republicans have power on the state level is not only the things you're talking about, redistricting, takeovers, voter suppression, but also, and this is included in this, the work of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's a group that basically writes conservative template bills that legislators can then introduce into their state houses. What are some of these kinds of bills that ALEC has promoted? I mean, I think you've already talked about some of them, but talk more about that.
Yeah, well, let me just first say that ALEC was definitely envisioned by the Powell memo. One of the people who was deeply involved in implementing the vision of the Powell memo was a man named Paul Weyrich. And he was part of the group that sort of developed the ideas. And he founded the Heritage Foundation, the Moral Majority, and ALEC. So, I mean, he completely grasped and embraced what Lewis Powell had laid out and was one of those people who really took it to action. So with ALEC, they had focused quite a lot on advancing the corporate agenda, just as you might think based on their origins. They worked against fracking limitations, and they work against efforts to raise the minimum wage. But of course, they focused a lot on democracy issues and have been churning out model legislation to corrupt the vote, to make sure that people who are eligible to vote can't have their vote counted if they're not the people that they want to be able to go to the voting booth and register their vote. So, you know, so they've actively pushed for photo ID legislation and shortening or ending early voting in all sorts of ways to make it harder for Americans to actually exercise that fundamental right, which is to participate in our democracy.
And that, of course, most affects minority people, young people, and just to put it bluntly, Democrats.
Essentially, yes, of course. ALEC has a very, very obvious agenda, and you can look at their funding and you'll see, you know, it comes just, it's exactly the same group following this Powell memo. And the big funders, the Koch brothers and others, you know, they've identified these centers of power. They know that state legislatures are absolutely critical. And it's another area where, you know, the left, we tend to be, you know, we focus on presidential. Look, right now, everybody's thinking about who's running for president. We have so many other races that are so important. State attorneys general, state legislature, secretaries of state who oversee elections. And on the right, they've understood elections matter. And it's not just the presidential. It's every single one. And you need systems that make it more likely that your side is going to win. In our case, that actually means standing up for our principles, which embrace democracy by expanding the electorate, making sure that all of those people who are eligible to vote actually can and do vote.
Now, has the Democratic Party countered this ALEC phenomenon with its own version of ALEC? And is that even a good idea?
Well, I think it is a good idea. There have been efforts, but, you know, unfortunately, they haven't been funded adequately. They haven't been as expansive as necessary. One thing people need to recognize is that state legislatures are often small enterprises in the sense that state legislators get elected. They are often part-time. They don't have much, if any, staff. And they need help. I don't think there's anything wrong with offering good ideas. So having a place where there's a source of good ideas and strategies for implementing them, for getting bills passed and so forth, is, I think, really important, because on the other side, on the right, is pushing out these terrible ideas. We cannot cede that battlefield and just say, you know, just resist the bad ideas. You actually have to have some ideas to advance yourself. So how do you protect fair wages and ensure that when people are sick at work, they can have a day off to take care of themselves or take care of their kids? How do you make sure that we don't have dangerous workplaces and that Superfund sites are cleaned up and that our schools are decent and all of the things? There's so many things that are important at the state and local level. And so we need to engage people. We need to support them. And part of that is supporting them with the good ideas that I know we can generate if we have the organization that is there, is funded to support them.
One of the real successes of the Republican Party in these years, these last decades, has been in getting so many people to vote against their own economic interests and to do so with great enthusiasm and then not understand that they were doing it and blame others like immigrants for the resulting economic losses that they are experiencing in their own lives. How did the Republicans pull that off?
Well, you know, there are a couple of strands here, and one of them is obviously race, and we're seeing that flourishing now on the right, the use of race as a divisive mechanism to separate people who have similar interests economically. But there was also, you know, one thing that is very interesting that I, you know, was reading about while I was doing research on the book is the co-optation of the evangelical right. You know, as I mentioned, Paul Weyrich was right there at the beginning, the man who founded the Heritage Foundation and ALEC, but also the Moral Majority. He and Jerry Falwell founded it together, and they were very much aligned in their efforts to work with big business and those who were undermining workers' rights and the environmental movement and civil rights in recognizing that their partnership could be extremely strong electorally. And what their partnership involved was basically not talking to these voters, sometimes refer to them as the Reagan Democrats or, sort of white working class or rural people who might have used to be core Democratic voters. And what they did was they played on social issues. And a lot of it had to do with kind of church, state, race, and gender, reproductive rights in particular. So they made a pact and they used the language of social division, talking about, prayer in schools and busing and abortion. And the evangelical leaders brought their people out and convinced them that it was right to support the agenda of big business and the Republican plutocrats, even though it just decimated their wages. It decimated their communities by getting rid of important funding to ensure that they had a clean environment in their community or safe workplace or decent schools. And so there is that exploitation. It was forged right in the same memo, in the same set of people who recognized that there was a group that they could bring to their side by playing the race card, the abortion card, and the church card, so to speak.
Right. What somebody calls God's guns and gays.
Yeah, basically. God's guns, gays, and abortion.
Right. And this is, it seems so utterly clear that the people who were gaining power by doing that really couldn't care less about these people whom they are using. And I think one of the themes throughout your book is the importance of just pure power, holding power, winning elections, calling the rules of the game. And one of the asymmetries between Democrats and Republicans, at least in this century so far, is that Democrats always seem to be very eager to share power, to reach across the aisle, to call themselves bipartisan, whereas Republicans proudly do the exact opposite. And I thought this was kind of symbolized by Joe Biden's recently bragging about working with segregationists. While you never hear a Republican bragging about working with a pro-choice person or environmentalist, what do you think is at the root of the Democrats' desire for bipartisanship and the Republicans' unwillingness to listen to even the most moderate centrist proposals if they're put out by Democrats?
Well, I think it's a reflection of a party on the right that has a very clear identity, which is very much white and very much male, even though there are women who belong. But, a certain view of America that's never existed, but they'd like to think it did. It's sort of a white America where working people had a decent wage and there weren't any, uppity women and people of color to interfere. And then on the left, what we have is an unclear sense of our identity, which I think is really unfortunate because we're the party of justice. Well, I shouldn't say, I'm not speaking in favor of the Democrats, but generally the progressive base. We are the future of this country when we represent the success of the ideals that are found in our Constitution, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. And throughout our history, we have gotten better. We have improved. There were obviously lots of failings in our Constitution, and there still are, but it has gotten better. And it's gotten better because people fought and died to improve it. And so we represent that hope and that future of an America that's capable of improvement. And I think we need to embrace that. And that is beyond any single identity that anybody might have. And I think that it's sort of, in the root of what Joe Biden had said is not understanding how to talk about that. Even President Obama had some of those illusions at times that the Republican Party would be reasonable to reach across his aisle and grasp the hand that he was extending them. But instead, they smacked it down. And they said that they were going to do it as soon as he was elected. Mitch McConnell made an announcement: "We are never going to work with you," even if it were legislation that they might support under other circumstances. Because it was Barack Obama, they would not support it.
And Barack Obama kept on reaching across the aisle anyway, and appointing people like, centrist people like Merrick Garland, thinking, "Well, maybe if I just try hard enough, they'll come around or they'll work with me," but they never did.
Yes, exactly. And, he appointed several Republicans to his cabinet. You won't find a Democrat in Donald Trump's cabinet.
Right.
He barely has, moderate Republicans. Actually, I don't think there are any. Now Rex Tillerson, Mr. ExxonMobil, is supposed to be the most, you know, the most moderate cabinet member he might have had. It's just a reflection of how far to the right the Republican Party has moved. And I think the Democrats have just not grasped that there is, it's unfortunate, I think, because I actually believe that you need a multi-party state, you know, to have effective governance, to have debates about, you know, how to implement policies. And, you know, it's not healthy to have one party that has basically turned into a exaggerated whites only nationalist party. It's a very dangerous situation for us.
I mean, it's a huge irony for me that while the country is so polarized, a lot of people want the same things. As you said, they want good schools, they want safe neighborhoods, good jobs, health care. And everyone wants a sense of meaning. And it's such an irony that the current administration provides its base with a sense of meaning, but pretty much nothing else. Then the question arises, what would it take for Democrats who are trying to provide all these other things to also provide a sense of meaning, a sense that we're all working for something greater? Like, what could that look like?
Well, I think we have it in hand, and I just don't know why more of them can't focus on that uplift, on, you know, who we are as a people. I think the preamble of the Constitution is the most important roadmap we have as progressives to what we need to be as a country. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, people should go back and read it. It is really the language that informs our understanding as progressives of the Constitution. It gives us an identity that's positive, that's forward-looking, that's progressive in the best meaning of the word, that is making this country a better place for all of us. That's what we're all about. And I think it's time for them to develop a broader lens on what they're selling the American people. I think the American people want to buy that. They want hope. They want a vision. They don't want us to have candidates who are going to get bogged down in a morass of details about every single policy dispute that we can have and never look beyond and above to tell the country where they want to take us.
Right, right. Let's talk for a moment about the judiciary. Another one of the successes of the Republican Party has been to prevent Democratic judicial appointments, streamline Republican appointments. Democrats have been very weak in this area. Talk about that. And you write a lot in the book about the influence of a group called the Federalist Society.
So, you know, Lewis Powell was a lawyer, obviously, and became a Supreme Court justice. He was focused like a laser beam on the role of the courts, as was the Chamber of Commerce and the constituent members, all of the big corporations in America, because they saw what was happening in the courts. They saw successful litigation holding corporations accountable for polluting, for harming workers, for discriminating against African Americans and women. And they saw that they were paying money and they wanted to be able to do those things without being held to account. So they understood that the courts were a vital place for that. And again, this sort of whole agreement and partnership with the evangelical right meant that they also saw collectively the importance of the courts as a place of battle over our view of people's rights to their bodies, view of people's rights to not have a religion thrust upon them, not have a religion embraced by the state, but by allowing people to have their own religion or none at all. And so they had a very strong recognition of the courts as a central place for all of these debates and battles to be carried out. Now, on the left, what you had was the Warren Court at the time. Earl Warren is the Chief Justice. You know, it was a court that was famous for a lot of the most important decisions that we recognize, from Brown versus Board of Education to protecting the rights of criminally accused people and so forth. And so somehow the left just thought they could take it for granted that the courts would be a place where fundamental rights would be protected. And instead, the right was building through the Federalist Society, which is an organization that's been devoted to pushing forward highly partisan, extremist, right-wing individuals to become judges, to directly attack these critical victories that have brought our country into the future. That is, especially around protecting workers' rights. They now have made major advances in ways to shield corporations from all sorts of litigation. and to undermine the rights of defendants who are being prosecuted, to attack women's rights, access to contraception, and so forth. And then, of course, most critically, as I talk about in my book, they've had a target on the back of democracy and really cutting back on protections for the right to vote. The Shelby County decision was absolutely devastating to the Voting Rights Act, which has ensured has been one of the most important civil rights statutes ever passed in this country, designed to ensure that African Americans could exercise their right to vote. Citizens United, which was one of the cases that let loose a flood of dark money coming from these plutocrats on the right, like the Koch brothers, to overwhelm our elections. And then, of course, the most recent decision on allowing partisan gerrymandering. And, you know, the right has a lot of money to put into partisan gerrymandering, and they are going to go to town.
I think it's important when you talk about, you know, there's a target on the back of democracy, to make it explicit that the Republican base is not large enough. It's a minority group of people to actually maintain that kind of power in the long run. So in order for it to be maintained, they can't do it by majority rule.
That's right. I mean, they see the writing on the wall. They understand that we're a nation that is getting more and more progressive, that it's becoming more diverse, that younger voters are really resistant to the kind of social policy that the right is foisting on them. They don't want to go back to an era where gay rights weren't recognized or women couldn't exercise their personal choice about their bodies. They don't want that world. And so the world is changing around them. And instead of adapting, trying to appeal to the electorate, I mean, there may be people among the younger voters, among these more diverse American population who'd be open perhaps to more conservative ideas around economics. But instead of trying to do battle in the realm of ideas and policy proposals, they'd rather just fix elections so that they can always win. And that's what they've done. It's changing the rules to make it harder for anybody to exercise their vote, harder for Democrats to win because the districts are drawn in such a way that Republicans have an overwhelming advantage, and harder for people who don't have a lot of money to have the same influence as a billionaire.
I keep using the word asymmetry, but it really does apply and sort of in similar ways each time.
It's a perfect word. Absolutely. Asymmetry is the best word to actually describe what's going on.
Yeah. And another place is the media. So you have this right-wing media, which is in many ways, you know, it's been called a mouthpiece of the Republican Party, and there is a lot to that, whereas the other side isn't by any means a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party. It's the mainstream media and programs like Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which are very critical of both Democratic and Republican lawmakers and officials and so on, and try, especially the mainstream papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times and so on, imperfect though they may be, try to really present an array of viewpoints. And so you don't have like the left-wing media and the right-wing media.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, again, was baked into the plan. One of the things that Lewis Powell identified was that the media was not writing in an appropriately propagandistic enough way about corporate America. They were being a critical, independent voice in reporting the news. So what they designed and what he promoted was an organization that would undermine what has been called mainstream media, which I don't know, it's supposed to be an epithet. It sounds like a fine term to me, but, you know, has undermined honest and, you know, truthy news reporting, attacking it, and then advancing a highly biased media in its place. So kind of displacing the general understanding that Americans had when they would watch Walter Cronkite or somebody like that, that was basically accurate. You know, as much as the journalists could find out the news and the truth, that's what they were reporting. They undermined that to displace the kind of fair reporting and then pushed in its place Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and all the others who could then advance a highly biased vision. Coupled with all of that, they've worked to have these fake news stories. I mean, the Koch brothers is a great example of how this works. So they, you know, of course, highly antagonistic to efforts to fight against the climate crisis by increasing regulation on energy companies. I mean, they get their money from oil. So, you know, what you do is you start by hiring somebody who goes and writes some fake report that raises some claim about, you know, an environmental scientist or contesting some of the findings. And that gets published in a highly questionable news site, you know, Breitbart sort of thing. And then Fox News would do a story reporting on Breitbart saying this, is it true? And then that sort of gets moved more and more into the middle. Then the Wall Street Journal will write a report based on the Fox News story, based on the Breitbart story, based on the fake news. And they work it through the process. It's a very conscious effort to basically take the news, what we used to call the news, and turn it into just a mouthpiece for the far right.
What is the result of that in the electorate, in other words, among ordinary people?
Well, unfortunately, you know, it's people become either they believe the stories or they become cynical about both sides, and they become cynical that there's any possibility of truth. And, you know, it really requires a collective effort from all of us, I think, to recover that interest among the broader American public in evidence-based reporting, in evidence-based policymaking. And you know, you see what happens in other countries where they've been faced with, say, Russian incursions into their elections and efforts to influence people. They actually put government resources into educating the public about how to be critical readers, how to understand which sources are based on accurate reporting or science or evidence and which ones are not. And we're going to have, when we have the opportunity, that's going to have to be a major part of the agenda, because unfortunately, things have gotten too far to just simply think that even if a good and progressive person recaptures the White House, that that'll be enough to undo the harm that they've done through their media.
Yet another difference between the Democratic and Republican establishments is what they fund and how they fund it. And this is something I've been watching for years. It's a really different theory about, you know, what, for example, philanthropists or major funders give their money to on both sides. What are you seeing? How would you like to see it change?
Well, I, you know, it's so different. Talk about asymmetry. On the right, they have these very large funders, individuals and foundations that come together and, you know, under this Powell memo idea, set a strategy that's the long, you know, they play the long game, as you said earlier. They understand, here are the centers of power. Let's build some organizations that are going to function to gain us control over those centers of power. And let's keep funding them so that we hold those centers of power for as long as possible. On the left, well, you don't have coordination. You don't have an agreement that these are the centers of power. You have a lot of big egos and a lot of special projects and a lot of very short-term visions. And it's meant that it's been a very diffuse response. Why is it that we don't have a major initiative from all of the major funders on the left just saying, how are we going to ensure voting rights are protected in this country? Or how do we ensure that there is no gerrymandering? How do we ensure that the census is done fairly? Now, there is some funding there, and there's better coordination than there's been in the past, but it's just too little. I hope it's not too late.
Another piece of it is in, I mean, it's all about infrastructure, right? Because everything you're talking about is building these infrastructures, the infrastructures of media, of nonprofit organizations, of the judiciary, of education. And one of the things, one of the pieces of the whole Powell memo and its aftermath was providing scholarships and creating journals and think tanks and trainings for conservatives, both on college campuses and beyond. Now, college campuses are already considered to be hotbeds of progressive thought and even progressive orthodoxy. Do you think progressives need the equivalent kinds of educational infrastructure in order to move forward, or are colleges already that?
Absolutely. And I say my organization, the American Constitution Society, we actually have law school chapters, but undergraduates as well. You know, again, the same thing that people say about academia generally is academia is generally liberal. Same thing they said about the courts. Oh, the courts are generally liberal, so we can just ignore them. Well, it doesn't work that way. Because just because, or journalism, right? Oh, journalists are generally liberal. We can just ignore it. The problem is on the right, they have very directed and focused effort to influence, to nurture young leaders in those fields, and to put forth points of view that are very much outcome-oriented. On the left, yeah, okay, great that, students are generally progressive, but who's making sure that they go into positions of leadership? Who's equipping them to be ready to run for office? Who's equipping them to make sure that they can serve in important positions to guide elected officials about good policy? So that it's that kind of stuff that, you just can't leave to the fates to take care of. You actually have to have efforts. On the left, we don't have these kinds of leadership development programs that are just rampant across the right, from efforts like at the Federalist Society to make sure that law students get clerkships with federal judges, that they get all of these great jobs, they become judges themselves, they hold their hands along the way. But there are also other projects that get them jobs on Capitol Hill or in state houses or in attorney general's offices or in the media, and make sure that their young people have been trained, have been given access to people who can mentor them, who can help them think through critical ideas so that they are ready to advance them when they're in a position of authority. And that's something we don't do. Again, we kind of sit back and think, oh, it'll take care of itself. Well, unfortunately, it just doesn't.
And on the Supreme Court, you see the fruits of that. I mean, you've got people who are from the Federalist Society sitting on the Supreme Court now.
That's right. I mean, Scalia was one of the mentors for the Federalist Society, and now you have those who were the beneficiaries of that mentorship. You have Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Clarence Thomas speaks in front of the Federalist Society all the time. They have a very much an understanding of how to bring the next generation up, how to reach down, give them a helping hand, pull them up. And Justice Thomas has placed his law clerks around the country. They were in attorneys general offices and elsewhere, and they were really primed to become judicial nominees under Donald Trump. And so these former Thomas clerks are now federal judges. And guess what they think? They don't think like we do about fundamental civil rights. That's for sure.
I have for years asked Democrats who work in government and policy why it is that Democrats rarely seem to have a coherent strategy, and the answer is always exactly the same. They give you a little smirk, and then they say, "Well, organizing Democrats is like herding cats." I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. So they're walking around willing to act like house cats, accepting their house catness as the immutable reality. Democracy is under attack and they're losing. Do you see that? And what do you think it would take to change that? Do you see hopeful signs?
Well, yes. Well, that's why I wrote my book. That's what it's for. It's to give them a roadmap to say, here's what we have to do. Analyze the problem, analyze the history, and give them an answer about how to respond. I have been somewhat made hopeful, however, because I think the Democrats are starting to get it, that progressives are starting to get it, that you can't spend. Policy matters, and I don't mean to say that it doesn't matter what kind of healthcare plan somebody advocates or other major issues. But God, if you're not going to win the election, then it actually doesn't really matter all that much. And so the Democrats on Capitol Hill introduced in the House the first bill, H.R. 1, which is a democracy bill, recognizing that this is the most fundamental issue that we face, is the destruction of our democracy by the forces on the right. And that unless we fight back, unless we make it priority number one, all of those great policy ideas will never come to fruition.
You've said some of the chapters in your book are based on this saying that was going around during the last election, the presidential election, when they go low, we go high. You write about that, but some of the things you're talking about, getting progressive people essentially to take a page out of the conservatives' handbook, have our own ALEC, put money into judicial races, fight ruthlessly for power. Do you think there are risks of losing one's soul, like becoming so much like the other side that you lose your values?
Not in the slightest. Because I'm not suggesting that we gerrymander and prevent other people from having their vote recognized. I'm not suggesting we engage in voter suppression. I'm not suggesting that we make the courts places where only one side gets a hearing. What I'm advancing is the radical idea that we actually take back power in order to be fair, because that's who we are. I would not want to advance a strategy that wasn't consistent with my principles and my morals and ethics. However, I think we're a country that is moving in a direction that is much more progressive, it's much more diverse, and it's one of those great times when I think principles and politics actually align. I think there is no greater moral stance than fighting like hell for something that's worth fighting for, like our democracy.
The Republican quest for permanent power, despite, as we talked about, the fact that they have only a minority of voters, right now seems to be pretty successful. It also seems totally unsustainable to me. I mean, there's only so long that the earth can sustain, you know, pollution, poisoning, garbage, the excessive resources put into the military at the expense of people, you know, the oppression of women and black and brown people and LGBT people. It seems like we have a choice to either course correct or suffer catastrophic consequences. It's sort of shocking to me, and it's hard to understand how even Republicans don't understand the long-term consequences of this raw quest for power. And I'm wondering to what extent Democrats perceive that.
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. I think that's what motivates me every day to keep getting out there and proselytizing on this, because as much as I'm hopeful about some things, I'm in real fear of the consequences of not acting. The environmental degradation we face is catastrophic. Now, I also, you know, I think there may be some percentage of the population that is just lost. I advocate going hard to get the people who are gettable. You know, 40% of the population, maybe not. But that leaves 60%. And again, to get back to democracy, you know, when you live in a majoritarian democracy, 60% is a pretty good number. So let's work with that 60%. Let's get them informed. Let's get them to vote. Let's protect their right to vote. And let's make sure the districts in which they're voting are fairly structured so that they can elect a politician of their choosing.
Inside of all of this, what do you think ordinary people can do, like somebody listening to this broadcast?
Well, there's lots to be done. And the book lays out a number of areas. But I'd say, you know, at a time when the federal politics looks pretty grim, people should engage in their local politics. There are some really incredible examples of states, municipalities, towns, counties that have been adopting really important advances, not for democracy, but also for people's daily lives. So raising the minimum wage, protecting people's right to sick leave, but also ranked choice voting, getting money out of politics by passing legislation that has a low donor campaign financing, giving people a voucher to give to the candidate of their choice so that everybody can participate in the system, passing automatic voter registration. That's all stuff that's happening at the local level, making sure you have nonpartisan redistricting in your state. That's a place where people can engage. You can lobby your state legislatures. You can run for office. Even better, you can make sure that your neighbors are engaged. You can go to your county council meeting and make sure that they are looking at some of these critical policies to advance democracy. Because, you know, the way it works so often is, and this is why ALEC has had such a big impact, is that state and local efforts rise up and influence the national. So there's lots to be done. There are lots of places that people can engage. And of course, importantly, people need to vote. They need to make sure they're registered, and they need to get out and vote.
In elections at all levels, national.
Every single level, yeah. Every single election, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Caroline Fredrickson is author of the new book, The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. She's president of the American Constitution Society. Thank you so much, Caroline, for being with us.
It was really a pleasure. Thanks for all you do.
And to learn more about the American Constitution Society, you can go to acslaw.org. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlffoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.